Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. Welcome, Gadi, Seneca regular, back on the show tonight. How are you doing, Gadi?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And a very warm welcome tonight to Kerry Brown, appearing for the first time on Seneca. Kerry Brown is, amongst many other things, most recently the author of Hu Jintao, China's Silent Ruler, a book all about our favorite robo-official. Where the meat of today's podcast is going to be about Kerry and his book, but let's just start off with our new feature that's still a bit of an evolving experiment called the Seneca Week, where we do a quick run-through of the week's news stories. So story number one was happening today, and I don't quite know what's been going on. Gu Kailai, or Bo Gu Kailai, as the Chinese government prefers to call her now, has been on trial. Gadi, what happened?
Well, they dispatched with justice very quickly. At least they did the trial portion very quickly. It's already finished in a day. And as far as the kind of the official narrative goes, the defense did not contest the charges, which are Gu Kailai and her, often referred to as the orderly, Zhang Xiaojun, accused of poisoning Neil Haywood, the British businessman, an associate of the Bo family, in November. And they're saying basically she didn't contest the charges. There's other interesting comments out of the court, including some more details about how the poisoning supposedly went down, which was that they were having drinks and tea together, and Neil Haywood had, I think one of the versions I saw is that he'd thrown up and had asked for water, and instead of water, he got poison. one of the interesting details that, if I read this correctly, is that she may have given the poison herself rather than some of the versions that had it as Zhang Xiaojun having administered the poison. But he may have just kind of carried it and been sort of an accessory to murder. And I believe based on that, they're trying to get a lesser sentence.
But the trial wasn't open, correct?
The trial was not open, although there were two British diplomats in there. There were friends and relatives. It wasn't open to the media, to foreign media. But there were friends and relatives of the defendants in there and of Neil Haywood.
Wow.
According to, you know, official account.
Kerry, how is this being treated in the British press right now?
Well, I think it's surprising that we haven't made more of a fuss about it. I mean, afterwards, a British national that apparently has been murdered. And I mean, it's quite extraordinary that we were willing to believe, you know, quite a while that this was all entirely innocent. I suppose just having two officials there is obviously helpful. But I wonder if it gives it sort of a legitimacy of the sort of process that it doesn't really have. I mean, this is an entirely political process, isn't it? I mean, really, it's the kind of prelude to the final treatment of Bo Xilai and nothing else than that. It's nothing to do with justice.
That's correct. And in a signal of maybe the next step, one of the tweets I saw coming out of Anhui today was that four policemen will be standing trial for help for covering up in the investigation. This could lead potentially to maybe charges for Bo Xilai ultimately when they decide what to do with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some other interesting news came out of Hefei today on Weibo. There was this post that went viral, a photo collage of what are apparently several Hefei city government officials in a group sex, three men and two women, and quite sort of remarkable pornography that's been circulating. Anyway, so something funny going on in Hefei today.
The harmonious society in practice.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Gu Kailai. Other story of the week really has got to be Liu Xiang dropping out of the Olympics, which somehow seems to be a much bigger deal for him because it happened the last Olympics. Did you, either of you, follow that story?
I watched it live, and I have to say, because I remember 2008 as well when he obviously wasn't able to do that race. And I kind of figured, based on the discussion of his foot injury that was kind of vaguely discussed before, that if there were odds given on whether he'd actually finish the race, I probably would have made a massive wager. I really thought there's some way he's not going to actually finish this race. And he ended up, of course, not even clearing the first hurdle. And it does look like he has a real injury. And it's interesting to see how the Chinese people responded, at least what we can see on Weibo of it.
Yes, his body is probably responding to the shock of seeing all those gorgeous sheep on the opening ceremony. I guess that must be something he's sort of still, you know, getting coming to terms with.
Let's move on to the next thing. There was an interesting article in the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune by Ed Wong and Jonathan Ansfield. I don't know, did both of you read it?
Yes.
So, Gadi, it was about tensions between the party and the military, right?
Right, and it kind of leads off with this kind of dramatic tale of a general maybe drunkenly angry at Hu Jintao, directly at Hu Jintao, who's right there, apparently protesting the possibility that he'd be kept off of the Central Military Commission, obviously China's most powerful body for the military. And it's unclear exactly how that's going to be resolved. By the end of the article, it sort of indicates that he's actually an ally of Hu Jintao and may end up on the Central Military Commission anyways. And it just kind of points up that there are tensions between the party and the military, something that's been emerging in the Bo Xilai story.
Well, let's keep that for the later discussion, Hu Jintao, and move quickly through some other stories of the week. There was a typhoon causing widespread evacuation in parts of China. Typhoon Haikui, coastal China battered by high winds and flooding.
I was not told I'd have to do typhoon pronunciations today.
No typhoon. So you can't help me with the pronunciation and you don't know what happened. Okay, there was a typhoon.
Know that it actually inconveniently canceled a number of flights to Anhui yesterday and to elsewhere in that region, making it difficult for journalists to get to Hefei for the trial.
I detect the hand of the Beijing Weather Manipulation Department.
Indeed.
Yeah. A Politburo-induced sort of typhoon.
We must make an inquiry of the relevant organs.
Okay. There's some police detaining 150 people in Macau casino raids, fears of a new gang war. Anyone, any thoughts on that?
I'd be shocked at the word of gangs or any sort of lawlessness.
Any kind of dodgy behavior in Macau would really be shocking. Yes, okay. Moving swiftly along. There seems to be some kind of bid by China to have various of the buildings around Tiananmen Square declared as UNESCO heritage monuments.
Including Mao's
mausoleum. Which is, quite clearly pirated from the Lincoln Memorial.
Right, it's very similar.
What do you think of this? Should these buildings have heritage status?
Well, compared to, I think, there are 1,000 UNESCO sort of recognized buildings throughout the world. I mean, if some of them are pretty unspectacular, I mean, I don't see that there's any great standard. So cool if they want to kind of do that.
I guess there's a political question about, I saw some kind of remarks about here's a person who was responsible for tens of millions of deaths, and should his mausoleum be honored as a UNESCO site?
But that's a ridiculous argument. I mean, dictators build the best monuments.
That's why
you wouldn't have.
I think you'll find that Versailles that would have to be taken off the list.
Exactly. That's why I outsourced the criticism to some unnamed person that I saw on the internet.
I see. Okay. Right. Enough of this nonsense. That was the Seneca Week.
Very well done. Let's congratulate ourselves.
Enough of this nonsense. That was the Seneca Week. Let's move on to our main discussion, which is where we will have Gadi Epstein interrogating Kerry Brown about Hu Jintao.
For about, 15 minutes until
I have
to go.
For about 15 minutes until you have to go. Okay, so you've got to get it in quick.
Yes.
Kerry, the book was published just this year, right?
That's right, yeah. Well, I'll make it easier for you. Basically it seems a very paradoxical thing to try and describe someone who has done everything they can to be absolutely anonymous. And I suppose that's the sort of clue, really, the sort of Sherlock Holmes kind of clue. Why is the world's second, largest economy, the leader of that, and he's been leader for 10 years now, so anonymous? And in fact, looking at his speeches, the extraordinary thing about Hu Jintao is he has no personal register at all. He uses no reference to any personal biography, no reference to any kind of particular significant moments in his life, no sort of way that he speaks and tries to kind of use any sort of register of emotion at all. And that is an incredible thing when you think of the enormous dramatic changes that have happened in China in the last decade.
Now, you met Hu Jintao recently in Paris, correct?
I met his wax. I mean, I met the more enlivened, the more lively version, which was the waxer figure.
Well, you just took my line, which was to ask which had more personality.
Well, I felt something when I saw the wax figure. I don't know whether it was him or Angela Merkel standing beside him. You know, it did get a sort of response.
So this brings up my first question, which is, of course, the obvious question, which was, how does one engage this kind of character in a biography?
Well, I think that it's about control. This is, I mean, any kind of behavior, you can interpret it. And the behavior that we have from Hu Jintao is incredibly controlling. And I think if you see the narrative of since the 17th Party Congress in 2007, it has been about control. At a time when China has been incredibly contentious, in which there have been incredible clashes between different elites and sub-elites, we have this figure at the men, you know, the still center, the still calm center, who has been, you know, really kind of enshrining control and, you know, Wei Wen, these kind of policies. And that is an extraordinary thing. And I think that kind of, you know, shows a psychological kind of, sort of propensity to, you know, just control things, the way that the man appears in public, and the kind of incredible self-discipline. He had three really difficult patrons. Deng Xiaoping, obviously, who elevated him in 1992. But then Song Ping, who was the party secretary in Gansu, where Hu Jintao was in the late 1970s, early 80s. And then Hu Yaobang. And these are very different political personalities, and they were all very impressed by him. And whether we kind of, you know, find anything about his personality, the most extraordinary thing is that in the last 10 years, he has maintained unity. Even when we talk about the events around the fall of Bo Xilai recently, it has taken the shock stress and it is still unified. No one has walked, no one has squeaked. So that kind of controlling nature, I think, has been successful. But I suppose the big sort of failure of the Hu period really is no political vision. Where's the big vision for this society? Where's the socio-political changes it obviously desperately needs? And a big failure to deal with, you know, the kind of enormous inequalities in society that we see all around us when we're in China.
Now, I remember when Hu Jintao ascended finally 10 years ago, there was some, I would say, rather optimistic discussion in some corners, or at least speculation, wondering, is it possible that this could be, you know, quote-unquote, China's Gorbachev, which is such an absurd question now. Should we have known then, what kind of clues should we have had that was a ridiculous question even back then?
I suppose when he was party secretary of Tibet in the late 1980s, you know, he faithfully carried out pretty brutally the party policies. And I mean, the rumor at the time was that he just disappeared and let the party chief, the police chief of Tibet in 1989, you know, deal in April with the uprising then. And when it worked, Hu Jintao got all the glory. If it had failed, he'd have been able to blame his subordinate. I mean, this is just a rumor. I mean, Hu Jintao, you know, is a man of the party. He owes everything to the party. He has only ever been a party, you know, worker. And the world, the culture, the sort of very narrow sorts of, you know, kind of environment in which people like this live shows, in fact, that they're not going to think out of the box. This is an issue, really, whether the new leadership under Xi Jinping possibly are going to be any different. Well, they haven't ever lived in a different environment. They owe everything to the party.
Kerry, what do you make of the distinction between shopkeepers and princelings that is sometimes made in writing about the party, where the theory, as I understand it, is that Hu Jintao is a, you know, the children of small middle class of shopkeepers, whereas people like Xi Jinping are princelings. Is that a valid dichotomy?
I think talking about factions is a very nice sort of way of trying to simplify things. I think it's mostly about networks, and Hu Jintao is a surprisingly well-networked character, as is Xi Jinping. I mean, he's from a sort of grassroots background, a bit like Li Keqiang, maybe. I mean, more similar to that. But the point is that he went through provincial training, very deep provincial training in Gansu, with Wen Jiabao, actually, for nearly the same amount of time, 14 years, and then in Tibet and Guizhou, and then the China Youth League. You know, great networks and also great patronage. And if you put those together, you get elevation.
Well, speaking of that, there's a lot of rumors now as people discuss the upcoming once in a decade leadership transition, which is how it has to be said, that Hu is maybe a bit weak in this process, that he has a reputation for not having kind of taken care of his people. Is there any legitimacy to that?
Well, I mean, if you think it's about personalities, then of course that's a big failure. He hasn't, you know, kind of protected some of the people under his patronage. But I think that Hu Jintao would probably think of it more as supporting the structures and institutions and regulation of party rule. So it's impersonal. It's not led by ego. And maybe the problem with someone like Bo Xilai is with their return to sort of Maoist charisma. This is dangerous. I mean, this is a culture which I think is trying to escape from the stain of the Maoist period of charismatic leadership. But the great problem now is that the socio-political issues that China is going to face in the next 10 years will need charismatic leadership. You're going to need to sell policy. Politicians exist for two reasons. One is to give people a positive vision of why they're going in a certain direction, and the other is to sort of try and intellectually convince them. Well, I think Hu Jintao has intellectually been able to convince people of the program that he's been following, you know, the kind of stable growth and, you know, the idea that society is consensus-driven collective leadership. But in terms of an emotional message, it's been a dreadful failure.
Do you have much indication that we can, you know, credit or however word you want to use, credit, blame Hu Jintao for the security strategy of the last 10 years? You talked about Wei Wen. There's obviously the, I would say, erosion of rule of law over the last 10 years, even as the propaganda about it was increased. Do you specifically assign that to Hu Jintao, or are there other powerful figures that you put that to?
I think his patronage over that policy has been incredibly important, and maybe the biggest trigger. I mean, obviously he had more people in the 17th Party Congress in 2007 to, you know, really sort of fulfill this, and he's empowered the security apparatus, the Ministry of State Security and the Public Security Bureau. I mean, they've all been given a lot of power. Obviously, the uprising in Tibet in 2008 and in Xinjiang in 2009 and in Inner Mongolia in 2011. I mean, these, you know, kind of, I think, really sort of cemented this narrative that things were falling apart and you need stability. But how on earth you can have a society in which you spend more on internal security, I mean, $111 billion a year, than you do on your national defense.
Gary, can I ask you about those figures? Because that's one of those numbers that has sort of, you know, been bandied about the media, and I'm unsure of exactly its provenance and
I think it was
reliability.
The National People's Congress. Yeah, it was the National People's Congress.
So it was an officially announced number.
I think last year and the year before,
oh, yeah.
It was announced to the National People's
Congress. And it's on the record.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about $111 billion.
Yeah. Because wasn't there some Chinese editorializing in one of the rags about how, you know, that was nonsense and these foreign reports
weren't true? I mean, both figures are completely spurious because the sort of security apparatus, I think someone said it's 1 million people. I mean, and there
are
many,
a lot of stuff that's not really what we're talking about is domestic security. And the same thing is true of the military figure.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess it just shows that there's a lot of official attention, a lot of resources go into maintaining stability, this policy of Wei Wen, you know, maintaining stability.
But I want to press on this again because a lot of this is going to kind of go into what Hu Jintao's legacy is about. And there's definitely a school of thinking out there that this was more pushed by, quote unquote, harder liners on the Politburo Standing Committee. That
such as Zhou Yongkang.
Zhou Yongkang. Can you put a stake in that or...?
I think collective leadership is meaningful. I think that Hu Jintao has always been good at building consensus, and therefore I don't think that an important policy or an important policy direction like this would happen without, you know, collective support for it. And we see no evidence, in fact, even though Zhou Yongkang has been sort of under, apparently, you know, problems since Bo's fall. I mean, we don't really see big evidence for this. This is a squeaky tight leadership. The most incredible thing about Hu Jintao's period in power is that the political elite, you know, the standing committee has become a black box. It's no real knowledge about what the hell's going on inside.
You think it's even harder to see than in previous generations?
It's great for people like me who speculate and don't want their minds contaminated by knowledge, you know. I mean, we kind of, you know, want to have a blank sheet. But, I mean, it's extraordinary that such a major political entity, we have so little real knowledge of what is happening at its heart. In Jiang Zemin's period, there was a lot more, you know, leaks and kind of, you know, maybe debate that we could hear. Not now.
Kerry, I actually want to focus on one of your chapters. On the way over to the recording the podcast this evening, I was listening to an episode of This American Life in which they interview various so-called special education children. And at one point, they're talking to a teacher, I think, who looks after autistic children. And she talks about how she'd love to know what they're thinking, but she just has no idea whatsoever. Anyway.
I think I see where this is going.
When I see Hu Jintao, you know, I really do see a robot. I mean, for me, the iconic image of Hu Jintao was at the 60th anniversary celebrations when he was kind of stuck out of a limousine, a red flag limousine, right? And he looked like some kind of pop-up cardboard figure.
It was an incredible scene.
Anyway, one of the chapters of your book is titled, What Does Hu Think? Mm. So, what does Hu think? The subtitle, I guess, or the complete title is, What Does Hu Think? Ideology in the Hu Era.
Mm. I mean, ideology is still important in Chinese society. I think it's wrong to say this is a society without ideology. It gives cohesiveness to a very small elite. This is a sort of major society run by a pretty small elite. I mean, maybe no more than 3,000 people at vice ministerial level, that kind of level. I mean, really very small. And so, you know, they have a common language. Their language often, even in Chinese, sounds like medieval Latin does in the West. You know, it's something that 99.9% of people don't really understand. But it gives them collective sort of cohesive, sort of direction. And Hu Jintao's contribution has been the harmonious society and, you know, taking people as the basis, these sorts of things. And I think there are clues to the sort of big dysfunctions of the last 10 years. So you have the contradiction between a society of immense economic productivity. I mean, no one doubts that since China's entry to the WTO in 2001, it's exploded on any kind of indicator, a major factory of GDP growth. And yet, enormous...
Kerry, you're squirming your way out of the question. I asked you, what does Hu Jintao think? And you're telling me about GDP. Well, what does he think?
The point is, it's not about what he thinks. I mean, the point is that he has been the patron of particular collective ideology. And that ideology is, firstly, to, you know, sort of maintain stable, you know, stability, to maintain adherence to, you know, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, Jiang Zemin's thought, and, you know, the
Jeremy,
sort of,
before you go all BBC Hard Talk.
Yeah, sorry, I've been watching too many, I'm listening to podcasts of Hard Talk. Sorry, Kerry, that was so uncharacteristically
Let me just ask
me
one last question before I have to run.
Thank God. When Gadi's gone, I'll be nice.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'll stop trying to impress him.
You mentioned them speaking sort of Chinese as if it's medieval Latin, which I think is kind of an interesting kind of parallel to... there was a time when emperors were, there was like a last one or two emperors, maybe Constantine or something, who were speaking
Demotic, sort of.
Latin.
Yeah.
How long do you think, based on your research, before these folks stopped speaking the equivalent of medieval Latin?
Well, because the era of technocrats is probably coming to an end, you've got much more people from diverse sort of academic backgrounds in the Politburo. As I said earlier, I don't think that they can get away with just using this cool sort of technocratic controlling language anymore. You've got to try and appeal to people emotionally. And I think this is a sort of big challenge for party theorists, that they have to sort of, you know, do that emotional thing that Western politicians do. Although it's risky because you have the memory of, you know, previous campaigns, political campaigns from 49 to 78, which were very socially disruptive. But I can't see that you can get out of that. You've got to kind of create a new social contract with your audience. And at the moment, there's a massive de-link. I mean, you know, politicians don't talk to people.
I'm going to register my feelings about the rest of this interview by leaving an empty chair. Kerry, good to see you. Jeremy,
so
good to see
this
you.
Is something we can't do on a radio show, but we can. This is a podcast, and Kaiser's in California, so we can do whatever we want. So Gadi's actually going to leave the show, but you will hear from him later because we got him to record his recommendation before we started the show. So, Kerry, please, do excuse the somewhat rushed nature of this podcast.
Did I upset him?
Yeah, maybe it was something you said. Gadi is an American working for British people at The Economist, at which point I think it's actually, I have to... bring something to our listeners' attention that about somebody that you also know, I think, is Paul French. In the last episode, I used the word Ponzi. I talked about the Ponzi editors at Dunway. And there was a bit of a discussion about what this word meant. And Paul French, who's a Londoner, I think, you know, East End Hackney Londoner, wrote to me and Kaiser and said, Ponzi, interestingly, has two meanings. Jeremy provided the middle class one, i.e. Effeminate and snobbish. However, in a working class sense, a ponce is a man who lives on the immoral earnings of a woman. Worse than a pimp, as he offers no protection, but pretends to love her and gets her to sell her body to prove her love for him. To be poncy, then, is to be lower than a pimp, which ain't easy. Here to help, from Paul French. So I just thought I should make clear the origins of that word in the middle of that. Let's get back to Hu Jintao. where did we leave off?
Oh, gosh.
What does he think and the ideology?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I suppose the simple answer really is that you need some collective belief system in the party, I mean, in the elite. And, you know, the kind of stress has been on how to sort of, you know, put people at the center of policy, how to deal with inequality, how to create a kind of society where, you know, it's not just about, you know, sort of crude economic output. It's also about well-being. So, I mean, there's been attempts to try and sort of carry that forward. But the brute political fact is that, in fact, this is a society which is immensely successful at pushing out output, but where, you know, there's enormous disparities and obviously quite a lot of contention. And so it's a little bit contradictory.
But, I mean, it sounds to me like you take as serious and legitimate the some of the ideas behind the harmonious society, that the under Hu Jintao, the Chinese government does, in fact, is genuinely seeking to redress the inequalities.
They put a huge amount of resources into training cadres at parties. I think there's 2,000 party schools throughout China. So they put enormous efforts into, you know, this sort of indoctrination. Whether people believe it or not, I mean, maybe that's not the point. I mean, ideologies are sort of tools of power, and the system is about power. So if you say what's the simple thing in the end, Hu Jintao believes in the power of the one-party state and the Chinese Communist Party having a monopoly on that.
How different do you think things will be under Xi Jinping? I mean,
he couldn't be a worse communicator. I mean, whatever he is, he couldn't be a worse communicator. And I think, you know, in terms of articulating what China is to the outside world, Xi Jinping will at least offer something. Whether he, from his background, has something new to offer, I think the political capital and the political courage of the new leadership is, it's hard to really say, but they're going to have a pretty steep hill to climb. I think, you know, we look at the phases from 49 to 78, we can say, you know, the key thing is class struggle and purification of society, very utopian in its objectives. From 78 to now, it's been always about economic productivity and growth, and that's the creation of the sort of primary basis for, you know, a developed and rich and strong country. Well, now you're going into a period of socio-political change. I mean, you can't avoid that. The issues are about, you know, the structures and institutions and society going through huge social changes and their robustness, whether the whole thing will fall apart. And I don't think we can be complacent about that. Our Chinese officials certainly aren't.
You could sort of put a peg on it, actually, in 2008, really, couldn't you? 78 to 2008, in a way. I mean, China perhaps took a little bit of time to sort of catch up with the global financial crisis and other things, but that was 30 years of reform.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Was making a timeline. Yeah.
You can say the political positioning for any new leader is, it's very contradictory. Before 1978 and after 1978, China was very different in its objectives, in the objectives of the elite, in the objectives of the government. And that's a difficult thing to explain. How can you say that there's a cohesiveness and a coherent narrative as the head of the Communist Party? You've got to take a position on that. So Xi Jinping has said, oh, well, without Mao Zedong and the period that he was in rule, we wouldn't have reform and opening up. But I think that's a kind of really strange thing that we've now had 30 years of one style of leadership, 30 years of another, and a feeling that there needs to be something fresh. There needs to be a new mandate, a new united front, as it were, you know, a new way of trying to talk to people about why are they in this, you know, kind of extraordinary political project and what is its meaning in the end. And, you know, you can fudge that with growth. You know, you can say we always have growth and people will be happy with that. But at the end of the day, how do you kind of really reach their hearts? How do you try and appeal to them emotionally? And I think that Chinese politicians just don't like doing that. But I think that they have to start doing it.
So when Hu Jintao steps down, how gradual will it be? How will he exit the stage, and what will it look like after he's completely let go of all of the controls?
I suppose theoretically, as he's always been a party process man, and he's always done things according to strengthening, you know, the institutions and procedures of the party, you would assume that he would, you know, do it according to the precedent. So give up, you know, the party secretaryship this year, give up the presidency next year, give up the Central Military Commission post in, you know, 2 years' time and do it that way. Some people think he might be more politically daring and just give the whole lot up, you know, in the next sort of from this year until early next March, you know, including the military commission positions, and then just disappear. I mean, a bit like Zhu Rongji did. So I think he would like to do that, but I think actually it would be very tough because you have then a very, very sort of inexperienced leadership in a way at a time which is very, very tough. And that runs the risk that then there would have to be interventions afterwards. It would be very, very tough. So I imagine it will probably be a sequence going over. It'll be a long transition over 3 or 4 years.
How do you think, I don't want to say how will history view Hu Jintao, but with Chinese politicians, I mean, some of them, one can make generalizations that are not empty stereotypes. For example, Zhou Enlai was loved by the people. That is the perception. If you ask a lot of people, that's what they'll say. You know, Deng Xiaoping can be complicated. Li Peng, if you ask people, certainly in Beijing, generally there's a bit of a stink about him. Would you agree with that? And if you do, you know, how will Hu Jintao be remembered? Not in 50 years, but say in 5 years.
I think if this leadership transition is successful and it's reasonably stable, after 2 or 3 years, his period will be looked upon as a relatively successful one. If they manage to face the big socio-political challenges, building rule of law, enshrining civil society and giving it a proper legal basis, doing something about the transparency and powers and accountability of the Communist Party itself.
If they do that.
If they can do that, if they can start to do something meaningful about that, we would say, okay, so Hu Jintao went through a very, very sort of rocky period. There were lots of challenges, but he got them to the position where they could do that.
But that's a hell of a big if.
Well, exactly. If not, then we'll say that this was a sterile period, a period of missed opportunities, a period in which political reform was never really seriously done, in which opportunities to take village elections up to the sort of, you know, next level, the township level, the only sort of formal level of government, you know, above villages, the ability to sort of introduce proper accountability into the party, these were all fudged, and it was a period of great political cowardice. So really, ironically, Hu Jintao's political legacy is in the hands of his successors.
That is a fascinating concept. We're just about near the end of the show, so before we get onto the recommendations section, is there anything else that you think people should know about Hu Jintao? If I may be forgiven for asking for a soundbite.
Well, I mean, he's unique in the according to Wikipedia, being a man who only has one official joke, which is a joke he made to a bunch of, I think, American senators in the early 2000s when they said to him, when they met him, gee, Mr. Hu, how do you get your hair so black when you're, you know, in your early 60s? And the joke, ready? The joke is, Hu Jintao said, I'll tell you the factory where I get the dye from. That is the only official Hu Jintao joke. Absolutely must be true because it's on Wikipedia, which is the source of all truth. So
it
therefore,
is, yes.
that's probably the thing we'll remember. But history will remember him as the man with the hair from the dye factory in Anhui, probably.
Kerry, I want to ask you one last thing before we go to the recommendations, actually. Is not about Hu Jintao, but about you are about to assume a new identity or position in life, in geography.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
I'm moving from Chatham House in London to, in a couple of days' time, be the director of the China Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and the professor of Chinese politics there. So I will begin a new life.
My congratulations.
But I will take Hu Jintao in my heart. I will take him there, and maybe I'll even have my own wax figure made of him.
I think you should. I think you should. So your book, Hu Jintao, is available online, and we'll post some links to places you can get it. Right, so at the end of every show, we do a section of recommendations. Gadi, we're going to actually welcome him back through a mysterious process of pre-recording his recommendations. So Gadi, what you got for us this week?
All right. This was pre-recorded, so whatever they said after I left, just disregard. If it was negative about me, if it was positive about me, fine. My recommendation this week is Jerusalem by Simon Sebag Montefiore. And I don't recall if I actually recommended this last time because it's a long book and I've been in it for a while. But it's well worth reading. It's a great kind of historical tale that also kind of gets at the notion of who owns a place and who owns the history of a place, which I think can be relevant for considering China today.
This is a terrible indictment that my mind has gone completely blank.
I'm sorry. I know what it feels like. I sometimes too.
You know what? There's only one place on the planet where I'm ever asked by passport control what I do, which is a really tiny sort of station called Ebbsfleet International in near London, where you get the train from Paris. And once the immigration guy took my passport, and in the way that only British immigration people can, looked long and hard at it, looked at me, and then said, "So what you do, sir?" And I said, I'm an academic. So he looked really, really suspicious. And then he said, "What area?" And I said, "International relations." And then he looked even more suspicious.
He said,
"What specifically?" And I said, "Asia." And he was just about to put me in jail. You know, he obviously thought I was some dodgy child trafficking, you know, sort of. This question's also made me kind of completely, my mind go completely blank. But I suppose the book in recent times that I've most enjoyed reading about China is Yu Hua's, you know, China in 10 Words. I really enjoyed that. I thought it was incredibly funny. And actually trying to distill the complexity of China into particular words. It comes back to what we were talking about, you know, Hu Jintao and the way he uses language. This is an incredibly sort of rich linguistic territory. And I think the way that Yu Hua sort of takes particular words like the people and how they've been kind of pinched by political elites and actually how there's a sort of countercurrent of people sort of trying to get the meaning of these words back. I think that was a really lovely book. I really enjoyed reading that. That taught me a lot.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to do a kind of toot my own horn type of recommendation today. It's not totally mine, but a project that I and my Dunway colleagues have been closely involved with, which is also connected with Australia. It's a project of the Australian Centre on China in the World at Australian National University called The China Story. And the website will launch tomorrow, thechinastory.org. It's a book, small print run and a free PDF and Kindle and iPad versions, and also a website. And the book is a yearbook that covers the last year. It was originally intended to basically cover 2011, but the theme of the book was Red Rising originally, referring to Bo Xilai and the neo-Maoist currents in Chinese political thought. But as we were finalizing the book, of course, there was certain events in Chengdu, and the whole subject had to be changed. Anyway, so it's a yearbook. So it took us until the summer to get it out because, Bo Xilai basically made our work difficult. And it'll be free for download on thechinastory.org. Not chinastory.org, which leads to some kind of hippie yoga site. This is thechinastory.org with the definite article.
It usually makes a difference. The definite article usually makes a difference. It definitely makes a difference.
Kerry Brown, it's been a real pleasure. And everybody go buy his book about Hu Jintao. Good evening.
Thank you very much.